One secret North Korea is not keeping. The isolated communist country today claims it has joined the elite club of nuclear-armed nations with a successful test of a nuclear weapon last night. In response, the UN Security Council today condemned North Korea and demanded it return to six-party talks on its weapons program. Meanwhile, Iranian state radio blamed the nuclear test on U.S. pressure, saying it was a reaction to America's threats and humiliation. Maggie Farley is UN Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. She joins us now from New York. Maggie, first of all, what are people there saying about this test? The Russians have said it was as big as Hiroshima. Others have said smaller, and there's questions about whether or not a weapon can be delivered. So what is the sense of what happened?
Well, there are conflicting reports about the size of the explosion. South Korea's Geological Institute said that it was much smaller than the two nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But France's Atomic Commission said that it was about the same size. Nobody really knows about how big it is, and U.S. sniffer planes are flying over trying to detect actual radiation leakage, but still there's a lot of stuff up in the air.
Well, we heard the Security Council response. We hear from people in the room that there was no protection for North Korea inside that room. John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., is calling for sanctions against North Korea. What is the thinking about what might happen?
It looks like China and Russia, who are the ones who are sort of reluctant protectors of North Korea and the Security Council, are now ready to join in on a sanctions resolution. Bolton presented 13 elements that the U.S. would like to see in a resolution, and the Security Council experts will be meeting on that later today. Some of the elements include a ban on all trade and assets relating to weapons of mass destruction, an arms embargo, a financial freeze on funds and assets related to the missile and nuclear programs. They want to stop the counterfeiting of U.S. dollars, they say, are financing those programs, and they're also banning luxury goods.
Well, and we know North Korea relies on foreign aid to feed its 23 million people, and there's thinking that many of those are already potentially starving. What is the thinking about whether sanctions will make life worse?
It will certainly make life worse, and already the World Food Program, the U.N. agency that helps feed the people there, has had to cut back its delivery considerably. The question is, how much more pressure can you put on North Korea without causing the whole place to crumble and have refugees pouring across the Chinese and Russian borders? That's why China and Russia are so reluctant to really push hard. But they also hold all the cards in their hands. China provides most of North Korea's oil, does a lot of trade with North Korea, and much of their goods come across the Chinese and Russian borders. So if they're trying to do a goods embargo or a trade ban, it's going to be up to China and Russia to enforce it.
Well, finally, Maggie, this all comes as the Security Council today officially nominated South Korea's foreign minister to succeed Kofi Annan as Secretary General. He says North Korea will be a top priority. He even plans to visit North Korea. Is he the right man at the right time or too close? We thought Secretary's General, there was sort of an unwritten rule that they couldn't deliberate in issues right on their border.
I actually asked him about this last week when I interviewed Ban Ki-moon before he was officially named. And there's not a hard and fast rule, but it is considered a conflict of interest by some. But he says that he brings experience and expertise to the issue that no one else has had in the position, and he wants to visit North Korea personally, and that he can separate U.N. issues from his national interests.
And some might say perhaps this is a different approach that's needed. Kofi Annan, I don't believe, ever visited North Korea.
That's right. Kofi Annan hasn't visited North Korea. Maybe he'll feel compelled to go in his last couple of months in office.
And finally, we're going to speak to an analyst later in the program about the impact on the region, but he says that, in particular, this is seen as a loss of face for China.
Well, China, along with Korea, had argued for very quiet, behind-the-scenes diplomacy, sticking to six-party talks, keeping it out of the Security Council. And the United States just had to place its faith in Beijing to handle the situation. But this looks like a repudiation of that strategy. Others blame the United States for provoking the attack because the nuclear test, because just 4 days after the six-party talks had come up with a substantial agreement last year, the United States came out with this economic sanction. So it seemed like it was shaking North Korea's hand with one hand and slapping it in the face with the other.
Again, we'll hear more analysis later in the program. But Maggie Farley, UN Bureau Chief of the Los Angeles Times, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, why is massive China so at the mercy of North Korea or any country for that matter? One aspect of that question is at the center of an upcoming film from the Discovery Channel. It's posed, the question, by New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof.
It's the West that is dominant today in the world rather than the East. Anybody for the first half of the last millennium would have been confident that it would be China who would be the major player in the world economy and in the global military. And instead, about halfway through the millennium, something happened, and in fact it was Europe and people of European stock who ended up triumphant today. The key question is how that came to happen.
The film concludes that the answer is the Chinese failed to recognize the importance of Zheng He. Zheng He was a 7-foot-tall Muslim Chinese eunuch castrated in the 1300s by troops sent to quell the Mongolian uprising in his native Hunan province, later elevated to admiral by the next Ming emperor, who sent him to explore the world with the largest fleet to ever sail the seas. In fact, there would be none larger till the 20th century.
The achievement of moving 300 boats and 28,000 men around the Indian Ocean basin was extraordinary. They were navigating by the stars. They were, the only time calculation they had was a candle, and they were measuring the speed of the boat by dropping a stick off the bow, and as it passed, they would recite a rhyme. These were extremely crude navigational tools, and yet they managed to get from point to point in the Indian Ocean basin with extreme accuracy.
Author Louise Lavati's in the Discovery Channel film Ghost Fleet, The Epic Voyage of Zheng He, the story of the explorer who sailed 100 years before Columbus. So what happened to him, to his fleet? National Geographic photographer Michael Yamashita decided to find out. He's the driving force behind the new film, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
You and I have spoken about this, and I was stunned. I had no idea that China even had a naval fleet that early on, much less an explorer like this. Were you surprised?
Well, my area of interest and expertise is Asia, and I've been working pretty constantly for National Geographic in that part of the world for over 25 years, and I had never heard of Zheng He either. And, of course, when you're a specialist and you spend all that time out there, it was a super surprise to hear the name for the first time about 3 years ago.
You first heard of him when someone handed you the book 1421. It's Gavin Mincy's book. Now, Mincy is one of many who says that Zheng He discovered America. You say what?
Well, I don't think many experts would agree with that. And I love Gavin Mincy's for the attention he's brought to Zheng He and telling the world about this explorer. Yeah, Mincy's claims Zheng He went everywhere, of course, before Columbus and the age of exploration using Chinese maps. And, of course, therefore, in going to America first, he supplied a map for Christopher Columbus to follow in his footsteps.
Well, and if that's been discredited by most experts, what did he do? Because you decided to trace his voyage. What was that voyage? Where did you go?
Well, what's known for sure is he made it to the Swahili coast of Africa. And that in itself is a pretty big deal, especially since he was sailing in this huge fleet with some of the ships as big as 400 feet long. It's even hard to imagine a wooden ship bigger than a football field. And anyway, with very primitive navigation tools, 300 ships, 27,000 men, as opposed to Columbus's Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria with three little ships about 100 foot long. It's just amazing. It just boggles the mind to envision this this huge floating city that Zheng He traveled with.
In fact, there's a scene at the beginning of the film where you ask us to imagine what that fleet would look like as it came on the horizon, you know, at Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Africa.
We had a section of CGI, computer graphics, to illustrate this huge fleet. And you might remember the movie Troy, when the camera pans out on one ship and it turns into this huge fleet of Spartan ships attacking Troy. Well, we wanted the same effect because, one of the most difficult things about shooting this film is many of these things are impossible to shoot. Like to show the scale of this huge fleet.
The film takes us to the places where Zheng He went with his with this massive fleet. And you found that he is still remembered, in fact, deified in some of those places. Can you tick off some of the things that you discovered?
Well, in Southeast Asia, he is well known and worshipped by both Muslims as well as Buddhists in that he's a Muslim, which is odd in the first place, coming from China. And so that in Indonesia, which of course is a Muslim country, there are several mosques that have his name. Yet at the same time, because he's Chinese, Buddhists want to worship him as well. And they worship him as a kind of a god of prosperity because he brought a lot of trade and therefore prosperity to the region. In Indonesia, there's one particular festival that they hold every year. Thousands come, Buddhists, Christians, Muslims. It's a funny multi-denominational temple where everybody seems to be able to find something to worship about them.
Yeah, it's amazing. Again, you know, how many centuries later?
Yeah, and of course the most amazing thing is, again, that the West knows so little about him.
Right.
In Thailand, there are also some temples. In Singapore, of course, now he's being held up as a hero, and of course in China now they're pulling him out as a superhero as they are coming onto the world scene. They are using Zheng He as the fact that he traveled as far as he did. He didn't conquer. He didn't enslave. They're touting these values and saying, you know, we're out there now trading and going everywhere in the world, but don't be afraid because Zheng He was there back in the 15th century when we were also the superpower, the most powerful country in the world, and we didn't act like the European plunderers in those days.
And I was going to ask you why that is, because we also mentioned something else that was unique about him, not just that he was 7 feet tall, this imposing figure, but he was a eunuch. His father was killed, and he was castrated when Zhu Di's army of 300,000 sacked the countryside. This is in the Hunan province. He was brought to Nanjing, served in the court, and later, as we said, took over this fleet and sailed under Emperor Zhu Di?
Zhu Di, yeah. Zhu Di was the second Ming emperor and perhaps the best-known one because he was the one who had the greatest vision. He's responsible for building the Great Wall, as we know it, the Ming Great Wall. He built the Forbidden City, moved the capital from Nanjing to Beijing and then sent Zheng He off on these amazing voyages.
That's National Geographic photographer Michael Yamashita on China's Christopher Columbus. His name is Zheng He. He sailed decades before Columbus. So when we come back, what did it mean that Zheng He was a eunuch? And what happened? Where are all those ships? We'll find out after a break. And later, staying in the region, but in modern times, more on China's reaction to North Korea's nuclear test. That's all coming up here and now. And those are the sounds of ethnic Chinese in Malacca, Indonesia, participating in an Indian Hindu ritual of piercing their faces and backs with huge needles and hooks as a show of devotion. National Geographic photographer Michael Yamashita talked to a young man during this day-long festival.
So Aaron, how do you feel? Are you afraid about pain?
No, I'm used to it.
But that's interesting that this is an Indian festival and you're doing this.
Because it's from generation to generation, since to my great-grandmother up to today.
Ethnic Chinese in Malacca performing an Indian ritual. It's just one of the cross-pollinations described in the upcoming film Ghost Fleet, The Epic Voyage of Zheng He. And it's also one of the cross-pollinations thought to be the legacy of Zheng He, the 15th century Chinese explorer forgotten by most of the world. Michael, you found an African woman on an island off the coast of Kenya, thought to be one of the last of the Fomao people. They claim to be descendants of Chinese sailors in Zheng He's Dragon Fleet. She showed you a Ming pot she said was from that time. So what do you think? Is this African woman a descendant of a Chinese sailor?
Well, you know, again, I'm Asian, and I look at people. Here she's supposed to be have some Asian genes, so I'm looking at her and thinking, wow, you know, well, maybe she is. She's got lighter skin, you know. She has sort of almond eyes, but, you know, it's just a guess. And, yeah, indeed, she had that one piece of pottery. I'm not a pottery expert, but just an odd situation where they would have this pottery, they would have this oral tradition about where they came from. How else did that story come there? And that wasn't the only piece of pottery. There's pottery all over that island. In their tombs, they have the Ming pottery as decoration. So it's so odd. Yeah,
yeah,
so odd that many miles away, with absolutely no other connection or tradition with China, they would have these tales. It's a real mystery.
Well, in the film, you explain that the Confucians, who came into control of China, didn't like this idea of expansionism and you know, enlightenment and opening the country. And,
right.
And these travels were stopped. But what happened to these ships?
Well, their treasury must have been completely drained just by the building of the Great Wall and the Forbidden City alone. So, you know, these trips were extremely expensive. And the Confucians, being very much land-based, didn't see any particular reason to be sailing around showing China's might to the rest of the world. They thought that China was the center of the world. That's what China means, the Middle Kingdom. And therefore, why should we go out and, you know, explore when all the rest of these countries are so inferior to ours? So they basically shut down the fleet and burned those ships, burned the logs also, making it impossible to pass on the knowledge of how to travel, and made it illegal for people to go out of the country as well as come in. So China therefore shut down for the next, 600 years.
Hmm. And it's just amazing that now China is one of the biggest exporters and has decided to resurrect Zhang He as perhaps a good symbol of globalization.
Right. Superhero. Yeah, if you go to any of the Chinese websites, you'll just see this glorification of Zhang He going on everywhere. There are lots of Zhang He exhibits and plays about the guy and new museums opening. It's amazing how they... Well, they've always been pretty good at hero worship, I think. So this is just the latest.
And just in time for Winter Olympics 2008.
That's correct, and I think that's where it's all heading.
Well, I mean, the fact that he was a eunuch, I'm wondering if that had something to do with...
It definitely did.
Go ahead. With the fact that he wasn't a conqueror.
Yeah, well, first of all, Zhang He, by being a eunuch, was allowed into the inner sanctums of the court because he was no threat to the emperor's harem, and therefore got close to the emperor and became a trusted advisor and so trusted that he was given control of the fleet. Number two, yes, I think because he was a minority, a eunuch, he had a feeling for other minorities, both in China as well as outside China, and it was actually proved by a stone tablet that he had left honoring his father. The inscriptions on the tablet are actually about his father's views, and it turns out his father was very tolerant about other religions as well as and tried to help the poor. And anyway, these same traits obviously Zhang He had.
Well, in addition, we understand from, you know, just readings that the eunuchs in these Chinese courts became feminized. And I'm just thinking that, you know, perhaps he was the best guy to lead a fleet of 400 ships.
Well, we asked about that, and apparently he was a great soldier, so somehow he doesn't sound like he had too many feminine characteristics.
National Geographic photographer Michael Yamashita's journey, documented in the film Ghost Fleet, The Epic Voyage of Zhang He. And is the book of the same name?
Well, the book is Zhang He, Tracing the Epic Voyages of China's Greatest Explorer.
Well, for more on both, go to our website, here-now.org. And Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this quick note for you Americans whose teams are out of the baseball playoffs. So sorry about the Yankees. Not. Now have something else to cheer about. Americans seem to be sweeping the Nobels. American Edmund Phelps has won the Nobel Prize in Economics. The 73-year-old Columbia University professor is being honored for explaining the relationship between inflation and unemployment. The Academy said Phelps advanced the understanding of the trade-offs between full employment, stable pricing, and rapid growth, all of which are the central goals of any sound economic policy. Well, Phelps also pioneered the analysis of the importance of workers themselves in business growth. The Nobel Committee in Stockholm called Dr. Phelps this morning, and reporters asked him about the importance of his work.
I've tried to put the people back into our economic models, and in particular to take into account their expectations about what other economic actors are doing at the same moment, and also about the future.
The economics prize is worth $1.4 million. Phelps is the sixth American to win a Nobel this year. The awards for literature and peace will be announced later this week. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR. Top story, North Korea's reported nuclear test. Some analysts say we may now have entered a new atomic age. A small, diplomatically isolated, and by most measures poor state may have joined the nuclear club and thrown into question the basic security assumptions for all of East Asia. To help us understand this change, we're joined by James Steinberg, dean of the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs in Austin, Texas. He was also deputy national security advisor to President Bill Clinton. Dean Steinberg, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
And as we've been saying today, there are conflicting reports about the test itself. The Russians saying it had the force of 5 to 15,000 tons of TNT. South Korea and France saying maybe a tenth of that. And there also are questions about whether North Korea can deliver a nuclear weapon. But given, you know, putting almost those questions aside, what do you see of the importance and the impact of today's news?
Well, it is a monumental development and a very disturbing one, both in terms of the region, Northeast Asia, but also more broadly in terms of our ability to kind of keep check on the development of nuclear weapons around the world.
Well, do you think this will lead to an immediate domino effect of other Asian states immediately wanting to also arm?
No, I don't think so, because I think the real test is going to come on how well the countries in the region can develop a concerted strategy to deal with this. I think that for all of the countries in the region, that the first best case is to try to find a way to roll back some of the efforts that North Korea has made. But there will be long-term questions, particularly if Japan feels that the other countries in the region are not taking this seriously enough, and Japan feels it needs to resort to its own unilateral measures.
Well, and let's remind ourselves, others have been looking nervously at Japan prior to this, a new nationalistic leader. One of his goals is to change the constitution to allow for a larger military and defense capacity. It would seem that this would help his cause.
Well, I think the good news is, and to his credit, Prime Minister Abe really began his term trying to reach out to the key neighbors here. He's just come back from a visit to China and South Korea, and he's begun to at least signal wanting to rebuild the bridges to those countries. So I think that what he's basically saying is that his preference would be to work with the others in the region. He's been more willing to reach out his hand than his predecessor has done. And so I think if the three countries plus the United States and Russia can come to a joint strategy on this, that this may be the best of all worlds of a new prime minister who said, I want to begin by trying to work with others rather than just do it alone on the Japanese side.
And we're thinking, though, staying with Japan for just a moment, that this is a particularly important topic. When we first heard news reports this morning that Russia in particular was saying that this test by North Korea might have been as big as Hiroshima, of course those words are going to resonate in Japan.
No question. And I think that one should not underestimate how seriously concerned Japan is. From the beginning, not only with respect to the nuclear weapons program, but also North Korea's ballistic missile program, the Japanese have reacted the most strongly of all the countries in the region. They feel most directly threatened by this development. So this resonance is obviously going to be a very strong one in Japan.
You talk about Japan's new relations with China, new in that the new prime minister has just visited China. Japan often sees China as the power behind North Korea, but how is China viewing itself today? Some have said that this is a real loss of face for China.
No question, that the Chinese have been sort of seen as the ones counseling a strategy of restraint towards North Korea and of dialogue and diplomacy. The Chinese were very clear and vocal with the North Koreans not to do this, and the North Koreans have basically thumbed their nose in China's face. And that's why, in many ways, the key test as we move forward in the very short term here is what will China do, both by itself and with others, to indicate how strongly displeased it is about this. China has a lot of cards to play. North Korea is deeply dependent on China for food and energy, and so has considerable leverage that it can put to play. It hasn't done so very much up to this point, but precisely because this has been in direct defiance of China, there's at least some chance that the Chinese leadership will feel the need to act more decisively and publicly.
Well, and you talked about the good news being that it might act in concert with Japan and Russia. Can you, Dean Steinberg, just briefly remind us what some of the past strategies have been, most recently the Bush administration's six-party talks, and prior to that, the Clinton administration's more direct talks?
Well, I think, you know, the Bush administration has taken a very curious approach towards this, which is on the one hand condemned North Korea as a member of the Axis of Evil and the most dangerous regime on Earth. On the other hand, has been content to rely on a process which is very slow, depends on getting consensus among a lot of the other countries in the region, and clearly has not produced significant breakthroughs.
Of course, we should rush to say the Bush administration would say in defense of its plan that it didn't want to be in solo talks with China because it was rather with North Korea because it feared being set up as the fall guy.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, one has to look at the effects of the two strategies. You know, in the Clinton administration, we felt that as distasteful as the regime was, that we had a big interest in stopping their nuclear program. And while we consulted very closely with the others in the region, we were able, through both direct negotiations and a very, I think, clear policy on this, to get North Korea to suspend its plutonium program. And so during the period from 1994, with the conclusion of the so-called agreed framework with North Korea, where they agreed to suspend their plutonium program, that facility remained closed and no new plutonium for nuclear weapons was developed. It's not always a pleasant thing to have to sit across the table from a regime as repulsive as North Korea, but the stakes are so high here that we felt it was essential to get an agreement and to make clear that that we took this seriously and that there would be both positive and negative consequences depending on how North Korea decided.
And of course, some analysts have felt that North Korea was secretly violating the agreement with the U.S. during that time.
There clearly was signs that the North Koreans were cheating in some respects, but I think it's important to distinguish what they cheated on and what they didn't. And the most immediate danger was this plutonium conversion or reprocessing facility, which was producing actual material for nuclear weapons. That was the focus of the agreed framework, and that remained suspended during the life of the time that we were in office. There was evidence at the end of the Clinton administration that they were beginning a second, more experimental program, though the evidence on that really didn't come very clearly to light until thereafter. I think one should not be confused about the North Koreans. They have a proclivity to cheat, to lie, and the like, and we have to remain vigilant. But we also have to keep our eyes focused on what the real goal is here, which is to try to limit the danger to the region and to the international community.
Well, Dean Steinberg, in the few seconds we have left, what should happen now? You talked about talks, Russia, China, Japan. What else should happen?
I think that it's very clear now that what needs to be done by the key five countries is to take very strong measures to make clear that there is a price that the North Koreans have to pay. I think China plays the key role in that in terms of putting the economic pressure on North Korea. I think we need to make clear that if North Korea is prepared to take visible steps to move back from where it's gone, that there may be possibilities of negotiation. But right now, I think the key has to be made clear that we think that this is unacceptable and that significant consequences from all the international community has to come to bear through a UN Security Council resolution and by individual actions by the countries in the region.
James Steinberg, Dean of the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs in Austin, Texas. He was also Deputy National Security Advisor to President Bill Clinton. Dean Steinberg, thanks so much.
Thanks for talking with me.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Have Have you ever seen someone you admire do something you love to do and wish you could do it just like them? Well, the legendary Russian figure skating team, the Protopopovs, came to Boston this weekend along with other past and present Olympians for a popular Boston benefit, the Jimmy Fund Evening of Champions. So we sent the skater among us, Shannon Mullen, to meet this enduring couple to pick up some inspiration.
Skating is the only thing I know how to do that makes me feel graceful. The grace and artistry of figure skating separate it from almost all the other competitive sports. But in the era of the quadruple jump, these days I see more revolutions in the air and less artistry. So it was a luxury for me to meet two of the most elegant skaters ever to grace the ice. Oleg and Lyudmila Protopopov are the Russian team that won two Olympic gold medals in the 60s and revolutionized pair's figure skating with their artistry. He's 74 years old, and she turned 71 next month. But their lifts still look effortless, their lines are still perfect, and every hand extension is balletic. They've been skating together for 52 years since they first fell in love with the sport, and then with each other.
We were married in 1957. That is why next year will be 50s wedding anniversary. Gold wedding, yeah.
Why do you still skate?
Because we love skating. Without skating, we don't know what we will do without skating.
Oleg and Lyudmila started skating together in Leningrad when they were in their 20s, but their Russian coaches told them they were too old to compete internationally.
So we began just by our own, without a coach, without a choreographer.
Oleg choreographed their routines, Lyudmila sewed their costumes, and when they took the ice at the 1964 Winter Olympics in Austria, no one had ever seen skating like that before, and they walked away with their first gold medal. 5 decades later, some of today's best young skaters idolize the Protopopovs. Olympic gold medalist Oksana Bayul performs in shows like this with them, and she says Oleg and Lyudmila are her heroes.
They're two amazing creatures. That's all I can say. You know, they're one of a kind. There is nobody else out there like them, and I wish I could be like them. And we have to just cherish them and have them as much as we could, because people like that, they don't really come around.
The Protopopovs invented moves that pairs teams use today, like the death spiral, which they can still do. They train 5 months of the year, and their diet's sugar-free, so they're in amazing shape. They might be the oldest skaters still performing. But Oleg and Lyudmila are sad about what the competitive side of the sport has become. It's all triple jumps and quadruple jumps with little music in the middle.
Everybody, you know, same jumps, just they increase revolutions. Jump just several seconds. And between jumps, no skating.
So it's like robots, you know, repeating, you know. You are nobody with a jump. If you have no quadruple, so that is.
The Protopopovs say one day artistry is going to come back to skating. So they keep performing, partly to make sure younger skaters see what it looks like. And they say, with straight faces, they're training for the 2014 Olympic Games.
I will be 85 years old, and you know, I'm now almost 75. We can skate, and we can do all these elements. It's no problem.
Oleg gets a little offended when people ask why they don't retire. For him, he says that's like asking when they're going to die.
We will skate forever to the end of our life, while we can move our wings like a seagull. Probably it's better to die on the ice than in the hospital looking to the white ceiling ceiling, and with something, oxygen and some this. We prefer this.
On my way out of the arena, I went through my list of excuses for not getting on the ice enough myself, and none of them seem to stand up anymore. So this winter, the Protopopovs have inspired me to go out there and try to get some of my own moves back.
Hope that would be the result. Here and Now is producer and skater Shannon Mullen. The Protopopovs are off to Lake Placid, where they will train, and train some more. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. To a recent article in the Christian Science Monitor, eating out is the new eating in. The National Restaurant Association says that American restaurants will bring in over $500 billion in total sales this year, and that although wages have not increased, Americans would still rather spend their money eating out than cook at home. Well, some of the reasons cited for eating out, 60% of American mothers work outside of the home, and with grocery prices going up, eating out can be cheaper than eating in. Well, Maria Lisa Calta is a freelance writer and a mother of two who wanted to find out more about families who do manage to cook dinner at home most nights a week. She shared their stories and their recipes in the book Barbarians at the Plate, Taming and Feeding the Modern American Family. Last year, Calta and Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst visited one of the families profiled. Here's how dinner time unfolds at the home of Mary Kay and Stephen Knox of Sturbridge, Massachusetts.
Mary Kay, tell me a little bit about today.
I get up at 4:20 in the morning.
Ouch.
And I shower and eat my breakfast, get my children's lunches ready. I read the paper, I get them up, get them dressed, and leave for work by 6:30. And then I teach sixth grade. I taught a full day. And got out of school at 3 and picked them up and came home.
And now you're home and you're starting dinner, and how does the routine unfold?
Katie and Sam sit down and do their homework right away. I make dinner while they're doing it. They ask me questions. Sam's done usually first, and Katie and I work on the homework, and then dinner's pretty much ready by the time she's done. She sets the table, and my husband comes home.
How is it that you have the energy to do this every night, and do you do it every night?
I do it at least 5 out of the 7 nights of the week.
Why do you bother?
I think it's important, you know, health-wise, for my children to have a well-balanced meal. My mother instilled in me, you know, your three squares. I also think that when we sit down at the table together, we hear so much information. We get to talk about things, their days at school, problems they've encountered.
What are you making for dinner tonight?
I'm making meatloaf, which is one of my children's favorite foods.
Yes.
I'm making sautéed broccoli, a big salad, and mashed potatoes.
My name is Kathleen Hunter Knox. People call me Katie. I'm in fifth grade and I'm 10 years old.
What's your favorite food, Katie?
My favorite food that my mom makes?
Sure.
Is her meatloaf.
Oh, wow, lucky you tonight.
Yes, right.
And when you come home from school, do you really like it that your mom is here and cooking, or do you feel like no big deal, you'd rather go to McDonald's?
I don't like McDonald's. I think it's very fattening and very gross, very greasy.
And your mom said you like to cook?
Yes, I do like to cook. I help her with chicken. She breads chicken and she bakes them, and I help her by breading the chicken, and it's just really fun cooking with my mom because I get new secrets from her.
Go ahead. Just hold it with you.
My name is Sam, and I'm 7 years old, and I'm in second grade. I actually love McDonald's.
And do you like having dinner at home, or do you wish sometimes you could just go to McDonald's more?
I wish I could just go to McDonald's more because we barely never do.
Mm-hmm.
I feel bad for myself because my mom, my dad, and my sister don't like McDonald's. So.
And do you like your mom's cooking?
Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah, when it's like pork or steak or something, I love it. I'll eat it.
I'm Maria Lisa Calta. I'm the author of Barbarians at the Plate, Taming and Feeding the Modern American Family.
Tell me a little bit about Barbarians at the Plate. Why did you write this book? What were you after?
I've been writing about food for 15, 20 years now. I'm a mom. I'm a working mom. And I kept reading about the death of the family dinner, nobody's eating together, and I thought, I'd really like to go out into people's homes and find out what dinner time was like. And Mary Kay read one of my syndicated columns in her local paper. I had put a little note at the end of the syndicated column saying, busy cooks wanted. And she responded, and I called her, and we talked, and I thought, sure, she'd be great.
Hello.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Daddy.
Hi, Daddy.
Hey, pal. Stephen Knox and live in Sturbridge, Massachusetts.
Stephen, we have been observing your family getting dinner ready, and it's a very impressive, well-oiled machine. You're a lucky guy.
Thank you, yeah.
I'm sure a lot of guys wish they could come home to such organization and home cooking. I just wondered what your take is on all this.
I mean, I think it's great. Mary Kay puts a lot of effort into that. I grew up in a family of four, and we always had dinner together, and she did as well, so it kind of was important to both of us to try to keep doing that, even though we both work.
Why is it so important? Why not, you know, just all share a burger somewhere?
It's probably just more, as much tradition, and what I experienced and what she experienced growing up is it was just the most fun part of the day. When I was young and I had three brothers and sisters, and it was the time we seemed to have the most fun, you know, joking around and catching up. And my parents seemed more, you know, human and less parental at that time. It was just a time to really catch up.
Just to play devil's advocate, do you think it's sexist at all that your wife has to work all day and she's the one that comes home and does all the cooking?
I guess, yeah, you could view it that way. I try to offset that a little bit by being the one who cleans up. I clear the table. I put the dishes away and do the dishes after dinner. When I lived alone, I did cook for myself, and I have the capability of doing it. I just can't do it as well as she can.
God is great. God is good. Let us thank him for this food. By his kindness, all are fed. Give us Lord our daily bread. Amen.
The common denominator of the people I interviewed is that they are all trying very hard to cook at home most nights of the week. I think part of the problem is that most cookbooks present it as if it's always joyful and it's always sensuous and isn't food a delight. And, you know, making dinner 5 to 7 nights a week is a lot of work. Any way you slice it, it's work. You've got to prepare, you've got to shop, you've got to get the stuff into your kitchen, you've got to eat, you've got to clean up. And I think, you know, it's worth doing. It's a task worth doing, and you should buckle down and do it. But it's
why?
Not.
Why is it a task?
Well,
worth doing?
I think that sitting around together at the table, and it doesn't have to be an elaborate meal. You know, grilled cheese and carrot sticks is dinner sometimes, and it's a fine dinner. You know, anything that can get you together, looking at each other, which I think is really important, and talking is a great thing. And you have to eat, so you might as well eat well and sit around and talk.
What was there a common thread in these families that you met?
You know, I'll tell you, the only thing I really noticed was that they all had great kids. They knew how to talk. They knew how to ask questions. They would ask me questions. They would respond to questions. And it started to be a pattern, and I thought, maybe this isn't accidental. I mean, I do know that the recent studies are coming out about kids who eat dinner with their families regularly tend to not abuse drugs and alcohol as frequently, tend to have a lower rate of depression, have better social skills, and have less obesity and eating disorders. So there's a lot of social science there now behind that. It's also, I think, common sense.
Okay. Do you want broccoli?
This Italian good Caesar's dressing, but I have other dressings too, if you
prefer.
Okay, great.
I also find cooking for my family very fulfilling. It is a chore some days, but not most days, because they enjoy the food. I know they're getting a good meal, and it makes me feel good, just like they have clean clothes and a nice warm bed. It's part of what makes the house a home.
So it's another form of loving for you.
Oh, without a doubt.
That's Sturbridge, Massachusetts mom Mary Kay Knox talking to Here & Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst. Mary Kay, her husband Stephen, and their family were among those profiled in writer Maria Lisa Kalta's book, Barbarians at the Plate, Taming and Feeding the Modern American Family. For more about the book, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Hope you're having a great Columbus Day, and join us again Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.